This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 10th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. Now, today we have our weekly movie roundup with a film critic and great friend, Karen Krzanovich. On our silver screen today, we have Love and Mercy, the tale of Beach Boys legend Brian Wilson as he tries to balance a turbulent illness with his pop career throughout the 60s and 80s. We'll also talk about Dear White People, Justin Simien's racial satire set in an Ivy League college. And then we'll revisit the 1958 crime classic Touch of Evil as the BFI launches into its Orson Welles season here in the UK. That's all to come right here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to this show, Karen. Now we're going to begin with Love and Mercy, Bill Pollard's biopic about the lead singer of the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson. The film looks at his early life in the 1960s and also later in life in the 80s as he struggles with acute psychosis. This is done using two different actors playing Wilson, Paul Dano as the younger Wilson, and John Cusack takes up the role as we meet Wilson in the 80s. Now, how effectively does the director portray Wilson's life with the use of these two actors?
He actually does a wonderful job. Bill Pullman, this is not the first time he's directed. He's primarily been known as a producer to get back in the feature world. But he does a wonderful job of this very unlikely biopic. But you think, how can two very different looking actors portray the same character, Brian Wilson? And also, when you do a biopic like this, you're going to have people who know the Beach Boys' music, and you're going to have the other people who know every single movement sound of Pet Sounds. So you're going to have the fans on one side and the sort of general audience on the other. And I think that Love and Mercy falls very well between those two audiences. It can't satisfy both of them, but it's a fascinating look at the rhythms of a man's creative life. And when you're describing this acute psychosis, I thought, oh, I don't want to see that. But actually, we don't really see him in these breakdowns. We sort of see the surrounding moments, and also the fact, for example, that he spent 2 years in bed. So we see him occasionally laying in bed. It's a foot shot, so we just see his big belly and the bottom of his feet and his beard and a big four-poster bed, and the curtains are moving. And then we see that several times, but we don't actually have to be there like a love-in.
And, I mean, Brian Wilson had incredible talent, but the more you find out about his life, the story is quite surreal almost, quite tragic.
Yes. It's a showbiz story that we've heard before. For example, the Jackson 5, you know, the father was a real showbiz father. And we hear of how these people, these parents, manage their talented children, mismanage them, even though I'm sure they're doing the best they can do. The same went for Murray Wilson, who was Brian Wilson's father, abusive father, who basically shaped the group's early sound, took them to their standard, you know, surfer boy kind of tunes. And then Brian wanted to make something different. He wanted to make new sounds to compete basically with the Beatles. And the father wasn't having this, so they went their separate ways. And that combined with Brian's, I think, bipolarism, they say that now, this often happens with very, very creative people also are sometimes mentally and emotionally unstable.
Well, let's have a clip from the film to give us a sense of what we're talking about here. This is John Cusack, so in the 80s, and Elizabeth Banks as his future second wife, Melinda, and they're on a boat trip.
Having so much fun. I love being with you. And not with Gene and the whole gang watching us.
Gene told me to tell you that he was sorry about the other day, the barbecue, that Doug gave me the wrong dosage. Oh. And that's why it's good that Evan was here. So, you know.
Yeah, how do you know Evan?
Evan's Gene's son.
Ah, so we're still being watched.
Well, we could do whatever we want.
I think we should do whatever we want, too.
All right, on the count of three, I want you to get up. I want you to jump in the water, and I want you to come over to my house.
What?
Now. You ready? Come on.
Are you serious?
Yeah, let's do it. Just diss this scene and make out like teenagers. One, two, three.
Talent, money, fame, but still being controlled in the quest for freedom in stardom.
Absolutely, yes. He got involved with Dr. Eugene Landy, who by the time this was made, he died. But it seems to me as if he wasn't managed by his father, he was being managed by this psychologist, quote unquote, who was taking advantage of him, basically, you know, for his own protection, they say. But that's the wonderful scene that you've just played. It shows how desperate he is to get away and to be gentle and to live his life. And Elizabeth Banks is really like the ideal girlfriend in this, but she's believable. She has a wonderful performance because she's a car salesperson, and she takes an interest in him, and they just get along, and she's very smooth and very agreeable and just perfect. And she, give it a spoiler, but she plays a pivotal role.
Brian Wilson is credited as a producer on the film.
Yes.
How much involvement did he have?
I don't think he had a lot. I think they had discussions with the script. There was a short film and a previous film that was in the works. And it ended up being rewritten, I believe, by Oren Overman, who also did I'm Not There, which is the Bob Dylan biopic that has all the different Bob Dylans in it. And what he has said, Brian Wilson has said, that this is very factual. So even though Landy wasn't there to put his version forward, we can be pretty assured that it rests quite well between fiction and fact.
Good to know. Well, Love and Mercy had its international premiere at the Toronto Film Festival and has since rolled out in North America and now here in the UK. And for listeners in Japan, Sweden, and Greece, the film is coming your way in August. Next, we're going to talk about Dear White People, a satirical look at racial identity as four Black students head to an Ivy League college. Now, Karen, the film is much more than that. Tell us first maybe about the genesis, because I gather this was a crowd-sourced film.
It was. It was. Justin Simeon had come up with this idea, and he had, I think it was Indigo, crowdsourcing. He wanted to get a small amount of money together, and it was so popular. In fact, it became IndieWire's Project of the Year. They have a competition every week. that he got like more money than he needed. So he went ahead, and a lot of producers wanted to make this. He ended up going, I believe, with Red Code, which is an independent producer. And I'm very excited about this film. We are very lucky to have it in the UK because a lot of African-American or Black cinema from America doesn't come to the UK. And in fact, sometimes I don't think it gets global distribution either. But this is a wonderful film. It's fresh. It's beautiful. The casting is terrific. It's funny. It's smart. It asks uncomfortable questions, and it doesn't pretend to have the answers.
Set up the premise. What's at play here?
Well, there are four main characters. I'm not very some of them. The other ones I'm not that interested in. But we've got Samantha White, who's played by Tessa Thompson. And she's amazing. She is kind of a goad. She has a little book called Ebony and Ivy, which is about being Black on a campus, Ivy League campus. And she does a little show, which of course is that little. It's a radio show, discussion show, called Dear White People, where every week she talks about the culture clash between white and Black. For example, one of the famous ones was, if you have to have more than one Black friend now in order to be racially aware, you need two Black friends. And the way this is shown visually is amazing, where you have all of these white people together, and there's one black person that kind of like going, oh, that's, I'm not enough. You know? But it's uncomfortable, but it feels truthful. And it asks these very, very awkward questions like, what happens, you know, in tipping? Because apparently Black people don't tip. I did not know that, but that is one of the things they put forward.
Well, let's have a listen. And this is, in fact, a clip from the radio show, Dear White People.
Good.
Dear White People, dating a Black person to piss off your parents is a form of racism.
Dear white people using Instagram, you go on hikes. I get it.
Please stop touching my hair.
Secretly just want to call us niggers.
Dear white people, stop dancing.
Sam White's little movement needs to be cut down to size.
And that was a little teaser sound of Dear White People. Now, I guess It is a little tricky, you know, playing black versus white. Does it fall into stereotypes? Does it try to be too PC? Is it a reaction to people being too PC? We have lots of balls up in the air.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good way of putting it. It's not PC. It's actually willing to take Pandora's box lid off. And we're having a look at this because it's complicated. And as I said, sometimes it's quite on the nose. Some of the writing you think, ooh, do you really need to say it that way? It's put quite reasonably and rationally, I have to say. But we've got, for example, her ex-boyfriend, Troy Fairbanks, who's very, you know, very handsome and very liked and is trying to get on in sort of quote unquote the white world. She's got Coco is a girl that wants to be Sam, but doesn't have her star appeal. And I think one of the most interesting characters is Lionel, who is a gay nerd, but he doesn't seem that. He refuses to be labeled that way. He's got this booming, deep voice. And it's
debunking a lot of labels, really.
It really is. And I think it's showing that there are stereotypes everywhere for every race, every type of person, but individuals are individual.
What I love, I think this is a first feature
yes,
film,
it is,
you know, so often comedy, North American comedy, can be very slapstick. This seems very fresh, very original in terms of the filmmaking style and the writing style.
Yes, it is. It's fresh, it's smart, it's insightful, it makes you think, it shows you things, it doesn't hang around and it doesn't bang home any points. It kind of will leave you dangling, thinking, wow, it's almost like a pop quiz. But the thing that I'm really impressed with is the quality of the filmmaking. It looks amazing. And the cast, I cannot fault. These are all star roles.
Excellent. We're going to keep our eyes out for that. Dear White People did the International Film Festival rounds last year and has been rolling out in European cinemas throughout 2015. And it hits UK cinemas today. And finally, we're going back in time now to revisit a film that's being resurrected here in the UK as part of the British Film Institute's Orson Welles tribute to mark the centenary of his birth. Touch of Evil is a crime thriller made in 1958, but Orson Welles never got to finish the movie as he was fired from the set by Universal. After this, he wrote a 58-page memo that depicted what he wanted to do with the film, and in 1998, the film was recut to come as close as possible to the version he had in his head. Now it's been dusted off again. Karen, how does this version differ from the Universal cut?
Well, as you said, there is no original one. He basically handed it over to Universal and on time, I know, even if not early, and then went off to try and raise some money in Mexico. And Universal had a look at what he'd given them, mm-hmm. and it was too dark, and they couldn't follow it. It's a labyrinth of a movie, really. If you try and follow it, you can follow it, but it's better just to sit back and look at it because it's glossy, black and white, throbbing with life, tension. Your loyalties are tested at every minute. It's I think it's 3 minutes longer, but for example, all right, there are many changes, small and large, but for example, the Henry Mancini music that was laid over the top for the title sequence, that is actually taken off. And of course, that's one of the great things you think about this film, but it doesn't need it. Welles had a completely different idea for the beginning. And as you know, if you haven't seen the film, the opening shot is a crane shot of a bomb in the back of a car. And it goes on for 3 minutes and 20 seconds, and you've never seen anything like it.
Well, let's have a little listen to that opening shot.
Hey, Jim, you see who's here?
Sure, Mr. Vargas. Out on the trail of another dope ring?
Out on the trail of a chocolate soda for my wife.
Your wife?
Yeah, your bride, officer.
Hey, can I get through?
A lot of talk up here about how you cracked that Grandy business.
Yeah, what? We hear you caught the big boss.
Only one of them. The Grandys are a big family. Good night.
No purchases, Mr. Lineker.
Hey, I've got this...
You're American citizen, miss?
No, I got this ticking noise.
Yeah, okay.
No, really, the ticking noise in my head.
Mike, do you realize this is the very first time we've been together in my country?
Do you realize I haven't kissed you in over an hour?
And on that note, we're back in studio. I think what's interesting is these days special effects have to be quick cuts and CGI, but the suspense in that is one single shot.
Oh, it's I watched it again before I came on, and the jeopardy and the way you start caring about the characters because you're torn. It's this, the car is getting closer and then it's getting further. Anyway, I don't want to ruin it for anybody who wants to see it, but this was considered a B-movie. Universal considered it a B-movie, and now the French New Wave and people just discovering it now are seeing it for the classic that it is, even though it is not in Welles's original format. God only knows what it was, because the confusing 95-minute version that Universal had been circulating for years. And in fact, if you see somebody's got a VHS or a DVD of it, it probably isn't this version.
What about the cast in this film?
The cast is amazing. Now, Welles was used to, from the Mercury Theater and before, he was used to using whatever strings he could pull. So he gets Charlton Heston. And in fact, he was only supposed to play Quinlan, when you see Orson Welles, he looks really fat and close to death. He's wearing a fat suit, but it's so convincing. We think, wow, he got really fat. Vargas, who's Mexican, is played by Charlton Heston. Janet Leigh is his new wife. We've got Marlene Dietrich as Tanya, the bordello owner. It's a weird performance, but mesmerizing. And some fantastic, Dennis Weaver, for example, who came from Duel. Steven Spielberg, who plays a nervy guy at a hotel. It's just intriguing. And in fact, it is one of the very last film noirs ever made.
And in terms of people who may not be as familiar with Orson Welles' films, we all hear about him. Legendary.
Sure.
What influence did he have on the world of cinema, do you think?
He was incredibly smart as a filmmaker, passionate, gifted from an early age. And I think that he taught filmmakers not to be afraid to trust your audience, to be smart. That's the thing about Touch of Evil. He knows how smart you are. And he says, I'm going to show you a story that you can keep up with. I'm not saying that it's flawless, because there are certain things, like, for example, there's a rape scene that doesn't really seem to have the power that we would give it today. But it's cinematically literate. And I think that's what Welles has brought.
Brilliant. A Touch of Evil is being shown as part of an Orson Welles season by the British Film Institute throughout the UK this summer, and of course is always available to watch on DVD and I presume downloadable. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Karen Krzanovich, thank you very much as always for joining us in studio. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. My producer was Holly Fisher. We'll be back same time next Monday to talk art, but for now, goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.